Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, we'll talk about the best organic gardening methods on How Homeopathy Helps to Grow Great Gardens, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck and international expert agro-homeopath Kavi Raj. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Kavi Raj, Vice President of the World Homeopathic Association in the UK chapter. He's also the author of the international bestseller, Homeopathy for Farm and Garden, which has been translated into 7 languages with 12 new language versions presently in progress. Today is January 26, 2011, and you're listening to show number 14 of How Homeopathy Grows Great Gardens. Thank you for joining us today. And in addition, I'd like to give a plug to Dr. Robert Bruck. He is a plant pathologist at North Carolina State University who very often joins us, and I'm considering calling him another co-host. Kavi, how are you today?
I'm fine. Sorry for missing last week, but
No problem.
Things happen.
It's done and gone, and we're just moving right along, and we always manage to pick up the pieces. So today we're going to be continuing with part two of Plants Chatter or Plants Communicate, and I'd like to just let people know that Kavi Raj is also on Twitter, as I am, and there is a daily online newspaper that homeopaths contribute to. You can find that at, I'll give a link for it, but I think it's a bit.ly/homeopathsdaily, and I will look up that short link for you and put it on the blog. So we're going to have a perfect segue from last week's show about anthropomorphism and giving plants human-like qualities. Just like we recognize each other, we recognize the similarities of people in the same families, and so do plants. The quote for today comes from H. Fred Dale, who is a gardener. He says, "My green thumb came only as a result of the mistakes I made while learning to see things from the plant's point of view." So we kind of have to put ourselves in the place of the plant to understand it. How does that work out for homeopathy, Kavi Raj?
That it works actually the same. You have to look at the plant from the plant's point of view, because if you try to look at it from your point of view, you're going to make big, big mistakes. There's no doubt about it. If you look at it from your own point of view, then what can you really see? You have to watch the plant and see what problem the plant has. So you have to always take the plant as the center of investigation.
Okay. So plants can recognize themselves, and there's an article by Matt Walker in Earth News that plants may be able to recognize themselves. And so not only are we looking at them, but they're looking at themselves and each other. Experiments show that the sagebrush plant can recognize a genetically identical cutting that's growing nearby. What's more, the two clones communicate and cooperate with one another to avoid being eaten by herbivores. So obviously there's some sort of communication going on, whether we understand how it works or not. They're constantly investigating how they signal each other. And the findings are published in the Ecology Letters, raising the tantalizing possibility that plants, just like animals, often prefer to help their relatives over unrelated individuals. So is this nepotism? What is this?
No, this is the reality of how nature works. Plants are, of course, also conscious living entities, yeah, because without consciousness there is no life. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, anything living on the planet and inside the Earth is equally a conscious living entity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And from from this consciousness, they can communicate. Communication is determined by consciousness. If there is no consciousness, there is no communication.
Oh, is this related to the vital force that we speak of in homeopathy?
Yes, in the sense that the vital force in the organon, when Hanuman speaks about the vital force that animates the body, he means the soul. And when he speaks about the vital force that reacts to sickness in producing symptoms, then he actually speaks about what is called the immune system.
Okay. I think that also there's, the immune system is quite complex. And I recall reading on the Homeopathy World Community Network a little bit more about the immune system itself, and that it's, there's more parts to it than what the traditional medical organizations call the immune system. They're really dealing only with the physical aspect of the chemical reactions and the way that the mechanized method of the immune system. But when we speak of the immune system, we're speaking of a totality of the physical and spiritual.
Yes, and that includes, of course, also the mental and emotional. If you are mentally or emotionally stressed, you become sick. Now ask anybody who has worries.
Yes.
So worries are something to make you unnecessarily sick, because it is, you know, if we get too much into our worries, we have a physical reaction to that. And in plants, we see the same thing. Because
okay.
If we read the book, The Secret Life of Plants, there they found out that when a plant pathologist comes in, whose daily work is burning plants to see what is the elementary contents, yeah, that the plants would react. They would shut down. They would stop communicating. Yeah. Whereas someone who would love plants and like to grow them, they would react in a completely different way. So there we see that the plant is also subject to stresses. And if we look in modern agriculture, with its closed spacing and its monoculture, yeah, then we see that the plant is actually under constant stress. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So in the ancient days, they already knew this. I see that last time you spoke about the sage Brigu and the talk with the king.
Yes,
yeah?
We'd like to hear the second half of that story. I also wanted to just make a little comment from what you just said. It's kind of funny. You said that when the plant pathologist went into the room, this is the documented in The Secret Life of Plants, and because the plant pathologist was always doing some sort of an examination that was hurt or harmed the plant, it knew that in some way, it reacted in some way that it shut down or closed down, and then the person who loved and cared for plants, it would probably open up and be more alive in speaking to the other plants. And in my own life, I'm married to a plant pathologist who always calls me, "Debbie, you have a green thumb. How do you do it? I can dig up a whole tree and move it to a new location because I think it needs more light or a better place to be." And he says, "He says to me, you're killing the plant. You're killing the plant." No, because when I do it, it then flourishes and it comes back alive really well. So no matter what I do with the plants, and because I love them so much, I think that it, maybe they do recognize that in me, while he has a little harder time with them.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah, because his work is to take the plant apart and to investigate all kinds of things, and the plants know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the sage Brigu, he used terms not acceptable to modern science, but this exposition is actually very scientific. Yeah. We don't accuse Newton of using unscientific terms, although a modern formulation of the law of gravity may sound very different from his. So scientific language has also developed over the ages. We only have to look in Black's Medical Dictionary to see how terms have changed in the last 50 years. And that is due to more refined observation techniques rather than a better understanding. And, of course, modern science likes to conveniently forget about that. But just as we have brought observational accuracy to the highest possible degree, the old Vedic seers, they calculated time from the atom, and that's 5,000 years ago. They knew about the atom, and they came up with an accuracy we have not even matched. So, as I said before, consciousness may be seen as the unifying factor in that it is common to everything alive, even to and even to what you and I designate as dead and inert matter. For even that matter is the product of consciousness. A car is also the product of consciousness, like a table and a chair. Yeah. So,
okay. Well, they come from something that was once alive. Living from the earth.
And they are made by someone with a conscious intent.
Right.
Yeah? Have you ever heard of the Monday morning car? That's a car that has all the car ingredients, but not the car consciousness. And so it will always have some sort of trouble. It was built on Monday morning when the crew was having their thoughts still by the past weekend rather than by the work at hand. They worked on autopilot. Yeah. And so the consciousness was with the weekend and its inconjunct drinking bouts, birthday parties, and fights with the spouse rather than with building the car.
Oh, my. So their mind was elsewhere. Their mind was on the partying of the weekend instead of focusing on the work week. And so, the end product of what they built, there was a discord between their intention and their all of their energy, their spiritual energy, and what they actually did physically in the world.
Yes. So
we ended up.
A lemon to own.
Yeah. So all those people who get a car, that's they call it a lemon, even if it was brand new, because the workers were not altogether there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also not restricted to cars, but pertains to all objects made by other people.
Okay.
Yeah, they put their consciousness into that object so it works as it's supposed to do. And if they don't, then the thing will work haphazardly. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then people say, oh, yeah, I had a camera that always had such a temperament. Yeah, and so we can say even they call it a temperament, which is an expression of consciousness. Yeah.
So it kind of does go shift back to that anthropomorphism, why we use human language for inanimate objects.
Yes.
Is because in actuality, certain objects are actually related to humans by the fact that they were produced by humans, and we put our own touch into them.
Yes.
So there is a somewhat of a consciousness. I think it's kind of strange, but you know, you think about humans being on the higher level of consciousness and spirituality, and yet plants can have that same kind of a consciousness and be even more in tune with Mother Earth.
Yes, plants chatter among themselves to spread information, a lot like humans and other animals, as the latest research is suggesting. There is a unique internal network that apparently allows greens to warn each other against predators and potential enemies. Many herbal plants, such as a strawberry, clover, reed, and ground elder, naturally form a set of connections to share information with each other through channels known as runners, which are horizontal stems that physically bond the plants like tubes or cables along the soil surface and underground. and though connected to the vertical stems, the runners eventually form new buds of their own and ultimately form a network. Yeah.
Okay.
So through this network, they can communicate. Yeah.
Yes, and we have a network. We have the internet. That's
yes.
our network.
Yes, that's another network, which works in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, if you network like plants don't usually produce vertical stems, but the stems lie flat on the ground and therefore can be used as network infrastructure, said researcher Joseph Stufo from the Radboud University in the Netherlands. And Stufo and his team let loose caterpillars on white clover plants and watched them eat a single leaf on the network. And then the second set of caterpillars was allowed to choose between the damaged leaf, one that has already been alerted, and leaves from an undamaged network. And over the course of 20 trials, most or all of the approximately 15 caterpillars in each trial preferred the undamaged leaf to the leaf from the damaged network.
So certain ones were more tasty than other
yes.
ones. And these we don't know how many years he did this, Joseph Stufo, from the Radboud University in the Netherlands.
He did 20 trials.
He did 20
yeah.
trials of this specific experiment.
Specific caterpillars, yeah.
Right.
And
boy, he's from your homeland.
Yes, from my homeland. The feeding caterpillars, they will be deterred and they walk off to feed on other non-induced plants. Yeah. They
okay.
understand plants' defense language very well, as it is directed exactly to them. Yeah.
And that is a quote from Dr. Stufo.
Yes.
In his interview with Live Science. So
yes.
The feeding caterpillars will be deterred, and they will walk off to feed on other non-induced plants. So they can differentiate between plants that have been damaged in some way.
Yeah, because the plant that has been damaged has sent an alert to other plants in the network. Yeah, and so all the other plants in the network, they will although undamaged, yeah, they will still not be very tasty. The caterpillars will go to a group of plants that have not been alerted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So I guess I'm wondering how that works in terms of. We should go around and damage plants so that they will. It's kind of strange. Can you give it a little bit of further explanation?
Yes. Here is how it works. If one of the network plants is attacked by caterpillars, the other members of the network are warned via an internal signal to upgrade their chemical and mechanical resistance, making their leaves harder to chew on or less palatable. And that system works to spread the information amongst the plants and to ward off the caterpillars. It's like an early warning system, very much like a military defense, but then more effective, because each member of the network can receive the external sign of impending herbivore danger and transmit it to the other members of the network. That is what Stufo said. So the attacked leaf is lost. However, the remaining leaves are protected against predators. And the study is detailed in one of the issues of the journal Ecologia. According to the researchers, the principle of network transfer of substances is known for very many species, including numerous invasive plants such as bracken and reed, and commercial crop species such as bamboo. But the downside to these connections is that viruses often use the runner infrastructure to quickly spread. They enter the plant mm-hmm. via the leaves, yeah, and find their way into the stems and are then passively transported to all the network members where they cause new infections.
So you mean this incredible network of root systems and runners and infrastructure can be used against the plant, even though it's using that network to communicate amongst the similar plants?
Yes.
But
that's possible because
the virus can utilize that network.
The virus is so small that it can use that system.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what about, can this translate into humans? Like, how is it analogous to the spread of viruses in human systems and the way we communicate?
Well, you know, if you are amongst people who have viral diseases, yeah, then the contagious principle, yeah, which is in many diseases, this is what spreads the disease around, although everybody knows that this guy is sick and I better stay away from him. Yeah, but sometimes you cannot avoid it. And then as a result, if your own immune system is a little bit down, promptly you will get sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know what? In a way, it does translate, because you're always telling us that the root system is analogous to the mouth.
Yes.
And the mucous membranes in the human are what causes a virus. And in terms of...
Well, it doesn't cause the virus. It is the first defense against virus.
Uh-huh.
But if the mucous membrane is already affected by low immunity, then it cannot do its work properly. So in the same way, the plant gets the virus in the runners, and that's how it can spread.
Yeah. Yeah, and it could spread quite quickly. It could go viral
indeed. Like the first example that I came across. Yeah.
Okay.
When I started with the plants, the rust went from tree to tree in like 2-3 days. 40 trees were infected.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Stouffer, he said that many pathogens are host specific, meaning that they can infect only very specific plant species. And the main challenge for survival is to find a new host after one has been infected. And so specialists have an especially big advantage from network infections, as the physical connection between plants enables them to find genetically identical copies of the original host.
Can you repeat that so that I really understand that a little bit better?
Yeah. The main challenge for survival for the virus is to find a new host after one has been infected. And so specialists, which are host-specific, have an especially big advantage from the network infections, because the physical connection between plants gives them the chance to find genetically identical copies of the original one.
Hmm. I'm kind of having to think about that. The specialists an especially big advantage from network infections. What is their advantage exactly?
And because then they can go from plant to plant, yeah?
Uh-huh.
So they can easily spread that way. So they use it to their advantage, yeah, the network.
Okay.
Yeah. So Stouffer explains that it's comparable to a computer virus specialized to infect computers with a certain version of the Windows operating system.
Right.
And such a virus spreads very fast if all terminals on the network have the correct Windows version, while the spread is slowed down if there is variability in the systems.
Right. But you know what? I always had this mental picture in my mind of going viral meant a very negative thing. And yet today we think about going viral in a very positive light. In fact, each of us would prefer and want for our video on YouTube or our blog on the internet to go viral. And that means that it is contagious from one person to another, this information which is being spread all around this huge infrastructure network that we've developed by each of us playing our part in it and communicating. So I'm wondering if there's, you know, there must be a positive aspect to this virus in plants also, and how we can learn from that.
Well, it's not so much that the virus is positive, but what is positive is the example that I gave with the caterpillars, that when one caterpillar comes, the information also goes viral and spreads to the other plants, so they can't be attacked.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's helping
side,
as a defense.
Like everything is both positive and negative. So other entities can take advantage of that, like plant viruses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's every single thing in the world has a both positive and negative light. And it's all a matter of what you do with it. So if you have a, you know, very powerful bit of information, you could use it as a negative dark force in the world, or you could use it as a positive light force.
Exactly.
And so I'm just wondering, you know, we have all of this information, and how do we utilize it to improve our organic gardening? You know, what is it that we can do with this knowledge about when a plant is damaged, it creates an automatic defense system and creates these chemicals or method of signaling the other plants that make yourself not so tasty to this particular insect or infestation, because they're going to come and eat you up. So now, so this is kind of thinking like the plant, the quote that we began with, is you're thinking like the plant and you say, okay, so what can we do as organic gardeners to utilize this information?
Well, it's actually based on the consciousness of the plant and its predator, and they are very closely related. Yeah. So this can be used as a foundation for our thinking when confronted by such pests on our crops. If we can think in terms of consciousness, then we discover a completely new world of relations between plants and insects, whether they are predators or beneficial insects for the plant world.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to give us examples during the course of our shows. You're going to give us more and more examples of how we can think like a plant.
Yes.
And you know, are there people who disagree? Oh, go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you.
Yeah. So that is in Italy is the International Laboratory of Plant Neurobiology. Yeah. And Professor Mancuso knows it's not easy being green. He runs the world's only laboratory dedicated to plant intelligence. And at the International Laboratory of Plant Neurobiology, about 7 miles outside of Florence in Italy, Mancuso and his team of nine workers, they are busy debunking the myth that plants are lowlife. Yeah, research of the modern building combines physiology, ecology, and molecular biology. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Mancuso said, if you define intelligence as the capacity to solve problems, plants have a lot to teach us.
Right. Those lowly green plants that actually feed us every day and nourish our beings, they have a lot to teach us. But we don't think of that typically. That's not our way of think. We're utilizing the plant for what it can give us, but we don't realize it can give us so much more than just nourishment in terms of physical food. It has a lot of spiritual energy and intellectual energy to give to us. I wanted to go back and see, were there researchers who disagreed with the nature of viruses as causes of disease?
I am one of those, because when all the plants are sick, then you see also an abundance of virus. And then all the plants are sick, that's a result. So the virus is then also a result. So how can it be the cause? Yeah, the virus is only, if you look in the human body, viruses can only attack sick cells, because the sick cells have the markers that fit the marker of the virus. So the virus can go in, destroy the cell, and multiply itself to work on other infected cells, but they cannot attack healthy cells, because those healthy cells don't have these markers.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So the idea that the virus is the cause of disease is actually a misnomer, but that has been given to us by Pasteur. And Pasteur, he was a pupil of Bechon. And Bechon, he wrote the book, The Third Element of the Blood, in which he came to the exact opposite conclusion as Pasteur. And then Pasteur plagiarized him, turned it around, and presented it to the Academy of Sciences in Paris. And, of course, everybody had always been looking, how can we simplify everything? So they hailed him as a great man.
The easy answer wasn't the right answer.
Yes, exactly. He provided them an easy answer, and so ever since they've been trying to kill viruses and bacteria, and as a result, the viruses and bacteria luckily become resistant, because otherwise we'd all be dead, because without them we can't live.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's true. People don't realize that we're actually covered head to toe, inside and out of our entire body with how many? I want to say thousands.
Billions,
I don't know how. Billions of bacteria and other microorganisms that actually are living in a symbiotic relationship with us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, that positive and negative, that light and dark aspect, it's good that we have these bacteria and virus within our environment to keep us alive, but when they get out of hand and they mutate so that we actually cause them to mutate by using all these antibiotics and these heavy-duty drugs that say, okay, we're going to not become, you know, they're not going to become, what is this, resistance? You know, they're going to find a way to survive and multiply, and then we're not going to be feeling well. We're just going to weaken our own immune system. So that's what we have to learn, how to live in harmony with them.
Exactly. So not only are plants smart in how they grow, adapt, and thrive, they do it without neuroses. Intelligence isn't only about having a brain.
Yeah? Uh-huh.
And as you know, intelligence is actually the power to discriminate between what is good for you and what is not good for you. Yeah, not between what you like and dislike, because you know we all like drinking, for instance, a glass of wine or so. But if we like it too much, then it's detrimental to us. Yeah, so.
Right.
It's not about like, it's about realizing that, a glass of wine is okay, but, you know, becoming a drinker is not okay.
Right, you don't want to overdo anything.
Exactly.
We have a comment coming in from the chat line. Dr. Bob, welcome today. He says that there was an example of predisposition, and maybe he can say a little bit further comment to us to tell us where he was relating that to. And he says, we see this in many plant diseases. Only unhealthy plants become infected with insects and viruses. So he's corroborating what you just taught us today.
Yeah.
So the plants are really, really smart in how they grow, how they adapt and thrive. And they do it without, you say, neurosis. And intelligence isn't only about having a brain. And I wanted to mention that even today we recognize quite a bit about IQ, that there is intellectual IQ and there is emotional IQ. And it's just a new field of research today, but in terms of Hahnemann and how he taught us in the Organon of Medicine and what you said earlier in the show, emotions can play a huge part in causing physical illness and disorder, dysfunction, and it can be an obstacle to cure, even if we give the correct homeopathic remedy to an individual, if they're still having that emotional upset.
Yes. So, you know, the whole thing, one of the major missing parts in success he created is emotional intelligence, which is a concept made popular by the groundbreaking book by Daniel Goleman, which is based on years of research by numerous scientists such as Peter Saveloy, John Mayer, Howard Gardner, Robert Stenberg, and Jack Block, just to name a few. And for various reasons, and thanks to a wider range of abilities, people with high emotional intelligence tend to be more successful in life than those with a lower emotional IQ, even if their classical IQ is average or possibly even high. So these emotional intelligence tests will evaluate several aspects of your emotional intelligence and will suggest ways to improve it. So, you know, you should always be honest and answer according to what you really do, feel, and think, rather than what you think is considered right in the test. Yeah?
Right.
And nobody is there to judge you, just only yourself. Yeah? So plants have never been given their due in the order of things. They usually have been dismissed as mere vegetables. But there's a growing body of research showing that plants have a lot to contribute in fields as disparate as robotics and telecommunication. For instance, mm-hmm. certain projects at the Institute of Neurobiology include a plant-inspired robot in development for the European Space Agency. And the plantoid might be used to explore the Martian soil by dropping mechanical pods capable of communicating with a central stem, which would then send data back to Earth.
So what is this? In the European Space Agency, they're using mechanical robots?
Plant-inspired robot.
Well, we get a lot from plants. Velcro, we know, is from plants,
yes.
From burrs that we see. So instead of anthropomorphizing humans to elements and characteristics into plants, we are taking plants and we're anthropomorphizing what they have to give us. It's going
yes.
two ways, because we have zippers and we have Velcro and we have all sorts of things that really came from the inspiration of plant intelligence and how they managed to survive in the world.
Yes. So the idea that plants are more than hanging decor at the dentist office is not new. Yeah, even Charles Darwin published The Power of Movement in Plants on phototropism and vine behavior in 1880. But the concept of plant intelligence has been slow to creep into the general consciousness. He also did some experiments on plants with homeopathic remedies, to which we shall come back shortly.
Okay.
But at the root of the problem, assuming that plants have or should have human-like feelings in order to be considered intelligent life forms, Mancuso says, now what do you say, smarty plants? Yeah.
Okay.
After the folksy 1970s hit book and stop-motion film The Secret Life of Plants, which maintained that greenery had feelings and emotions, the scientific community has avoided talking about smarty plants. So while there has been a bumper crop of studies demonstrating that green matter can be nearly as sophisticated as gray matter, especially when it comes to signaling and response systems, few talk about intelligence. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Mancuso christened his lab in 2004, he decided to use the controversial term plant neurobiology to reinforce the idea that plants are biochemistry, cell biology, and electrophysiology similar to the human nervous system. But although mm-hmm. his laboratory is part of the University of Florence, where Mancuso teaches horticulture, funds for this fertile field of research weren't forthcoming.
Right. I don't think people were ready to invest in such a crazy idea as plant neurobiology, as if plants actually had a brain.
Yeah.
But we are learning more and more that they do.
Yeah. So in the beginning, they got a bit of lymph, 1 million euro and about 500,000 euro to come from the Ente Casa di Risparmio di Firenze. That's a bank foundation that mainly supports cultural events and art restorations.
That's really funny.
Yes.
That's really funny that they got their support and funding through a cultural aspect of the people who are really in tune with spirit as opposed to from a research endeavor.
Yes. So what convinced them to provide the seed money? And Paolo Blasi, a physics professor at the university who's on the board of directors, he said, looking beyond the name of the research, it sounds almost like a pseudo-scientific field. But even now skeptics are convinced because of the validity of the work.
Wow, I love the word skeptics,
yes,
because skeptics are like all over in every field of endeavor that is pushing the edges and the borders of our knowledge today. Those
yes.
skeptics are standing at the gateway of knowledge and just closing it. Their eyes are shut, ears. It's like those three monkeys. They just don't want to look, see, or hear what is possible in our world. But we're right there holding our ground and going forward to learn and understand. There are some more comments in the chat session. I can tell you what's going on. Dr. Bob again is there, and he says, when plants are weakened by environmental factors like air pollution, they become more susceptible to biotic diseases. And so we're destroying our environment and making our plant life weakened. And when plant trees are attacked by bark beetles, we say, quote, the tree was already dead, but it didn't know it. It attracted the beetles that put the final nail in the coffin. So Dr. Bob is so smart. And he says, he has a question for us. Is there a general constitutional homeopathic remedy that boosts the health of all green plants? And I think you've answered that numerous times, but he still wants to know again.
Yes. Well, actually, the best remedy for that is silica, because without silica, no plant can even stand upright. Yeah. Because the outer sheath of the stems and bark in trees is actually a form of modified silica. Yeah. So silica is the key to homeopathic agriculture, because it has many, many, many functions. It can help in seed germination. It can help weak and puny plants to grow properly. It is good after transplants when the plants don't thrive. There are so many applications for silica. Even Rudolf Steiner, he said, well, you spray your fruit trees with silica, and then you will get more fruit and bigger fruit. Yeah. So this is really, really the key to agriculture, which conventional agriculture says is phosphor. Yeah. But they think that the macronutrients are more important. But if a micronutrient is having an excess or a deficiency, the results for the plants are much more severe than when they have a macronutrient which is out of balance.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
It's a little bit off topic, but here you're telling us about silica and its importance in plant growth and every aspect of the life cycle of a plant. And once the conventional theorists or researchers, agriculturists, get their hands on this concept of silica being such a vital micronutrient, is it possible that they can over spray with this? What will happen if now everything is getting dumped with tons of silica?
Well, then you get, of course, silica problems. Yeah, if you overdo anything that you overdo, will cause problems. If, for instance, when the plant is flowering, and you give too much silica, then you won't get no fruits at all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So we really have to be knowledgeable and wise in our judicious use of homeopathic remedies, because we can give too much and they'll maybe have approving.
Yes, exactly. And then what you get is instead of solving of the problem becomes worse. Yeah, it exacerbates, and you get. Say, for instance, if your plant is very yellow and you think, yellow, we can have different causes, and then you give a remedy, and then after a couple of days you think, let's give that remedy again, because it doesn't look like it's doing very much. As a result of that, then all of a sudden the plant may all go yellow.
Okay, yeah. I have an example of that one. We're doing an experiment with a hibiscus plant, and you told me to give sulfur.
Yes.
And I did. And then after, I don't know, 5 days, some number of days, I said, boy, it doesn't look like it's doing as well as I'd like, and I gave it another dose. So now the whole thing is turning yellow again.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll see what we have to remedy that and find out what the next step is in that particular experiment. I think there's some more comments. Dr. Bob says, I think we should universally apply silica to all fields to grow the best plants. And then he says, I have used rock dust, which is mostly silica, to treat fields, and it works, but not homeopathically. Maybe the homeopathic form is better. He wants to try. And two, he does say that too much rock dust does kill the plant, and Kavi is right again. Ask Kavi the rock dust question. Okay, so we want to know a little bit more about the rock dust.
About the rock dust. Rock dust is actually generally used as a fertilizer. Yeah. I have a good example of that in India. There is one man in South India, and he says, I got stacks of rock dust. He said, okay, you grind it up with milk sugar, and you turn it into the homeopathic silica, and you give it like that. And then he sent me photos where his clover is not just 20 centimeters high, which is normal, but it is 60 centimeters high, and the leaves are bigger, and the flowers are bigger, and everything is bigger. And that's only after one dose.
Wow.
Yeah, so there his plants grew three times as big as before. And he was very happy with the result, of course. And then he asked me, shall I repeat? And he said, no, don't repeat, because then you will get the problems from silica.
Yeah. Okay.
Plants like human beings, yeah. If you give a dose of medicine and you repeat it quick, you do what we call a proving. Yeah, you develop the symptoms of the remedy. And with plants, because they are so much smaller and so much more sensitive and take up things only in attenuated form like homeopathic remedies, yeah. So if they get too much of anything, then you immediately have a problem. Bob can tell us that if you give too much potassium or too much phosphorus, you will immediately get an aphid explosion. Yeah, it's like opening a free McDonald's for them.
Wow.
Yeah.
McDonald's too. Well, I don't go there, but
No, neither do I, but it's just an example. Yeah?
Right. Okay.
So
he's going to try. He's going to try that homeopathic rock dust stuff now.
Yes.
Let me see how much time we have left on the show. We have about 10 minutes, and so we want to go back to the effects, special effects of plants, and how sensitive they are, and how they communicate. We talked a little bit last week about the fact that I changed the music for the show into concert music with violins and how soothing that is to our souls. And so in addition to the studies on the effects of music on vineyards, the center researchers that we were speaking about earlier have published papers on the gravity of sensing plant synapses and long-distance signal transmission in trees. And you've told us before that trees are higher consciousness somewhat than the low-growing little perennials or the vegetables, but that trees have a different, somewhat different consciousness. So one important offshoot of the research activity is in an international symposium on plant neurobiology. And next, for those people who are interested, there will be another meeting in Japan in the coming year.
So Leopold Sumner, who is an advanced concepts team coordinator at the European Space Agency, remembers that the term plant intelligence raised a few eyebrows when collaboration with the lab was proposed. Even on a multidisciplinary think tank team that's used to pondering ideas out of left field. But nonetheless, Sumner says, plant research may prove important ideas. Yeah, biometrics can provide some of the most inspiring resources for us, he said. Solutions found by nature that might not seem related to real engineering problems at first sight actually are related and give technical solutions.
What is a biometric? What is a biometric?
Biometrics, that is actually... looking at how plants do communicate, and how plants use their growth and their signals to help
right.
each other. Yeah.
So there are mechanical tools like wavelength detectors that
yes.
will tell us what output and signals the plants are giving to one another.
Yes.
Or to whoever's there listening.
Yes. So radical as that sounds, if it weren't for the lone sugarcane stalk perched on a cabinet, the lab looked like any other. Yeah. Luciana Rena patiently tests for DNA markers. Molecular biologist Giovanni Stefano analyzes data on two computer monitors around the corner. And during a visit to the lab's two greenhouses, where research is being conducted on the effects of light on olive trees and reactions in Venus flytraps and in Mimosa pudica, Mancuso points out a few neglected office plants sent there for a little TLC, tender loving care. Mancuso, however, is no plant whisperer. Undetended plants are a long way from understanding sweet nothings spoken softly to them, he explains. Plants communicate via chemical substance. They have a specific and fairly extensive vocabulary to convey alarms, health, and a host of other things. We just have sound waves broken down into various languages, and I don't see how we could bridge the gap. But when we consider how our own brain generates chemical substance together with and by the endocrine system, we might as well consider the fact that these hormones can alter the way we smell. And we can moreover understand that plants use pheromones we cannot detect to pass on their warnings, and that our hormonal substances have a similar effect on plants. Notwithstanding the fact that someone smokes or not, the plants react to finer pheromones than tobacco smoke, while reacting mm-hmm. to that as well.
Wow. So it's sort of like, you know, you have a dog whistle. They're at
yeah.
a different audio wavelength
that we cannot
yes,
hear,
and,
but
and
the dog
can hear
perfectly.
Yeah, the dogs can hear it, and they respond, and they come to you and do whatever they're supposed to. And yet, because something is not able to be detected or seen, does not mean that we need to be a skeptic to say it doesn't exist. And this is
exactly.
something that we have dealing with people who don't understand about homeopathy, that just
yes.
because we don't have the tools today to be able to detect and with biometrics and whatever, what is exact and explain everything to the last detail, that doesn't mean that you push the baby yeah. out with the bathwater. And
exactly.
you really have to understand that homeopathy does work, and we know it from our senses. We see the results of it working every single day, all over the world, in people, plants, and animals. And there's
exactly.
experiments going on in all of those places. The most recent we spoke about on Monday's show about Montagnier. How do you pronounce his name?
Montagnier, yeah.
Yes, and the fact that he's studying, he has to go to another country, actually, to do this research because it's not acceptable in the place where he is. And
yes.
he is actually looking at the signaling waves of DNA. So
exactly.
that's getting really, really tiny. And everything in the world seems to come down to these modes of communication between all organisms of
yes.
wavelengths. And
yeah,
this is our explanation. Go ahead.
The problem with these skeptics is that they are a placebo for real science. Yeah. They claim to be scientific and to question science, but really, you know, what they do is very unscientific. So it's a bit like a placebo, yeah. And
I'm not following exactly. What is the placebo that the skeptics are related to?
Well, they are the placebo for real science.
Oh, they are the
yeah.
placebo for real science, because real
exactly.
science means that they're open-minded.
They claim to be scientific, but they
yes.
are not. So that is placebo. yeah.
Well, I will have to
just like in medicine, you have the real medicine and you have the placebo. And, and in science, you have the real science, and you have the skeptics, which is the point.
Okay, we lost, we're out of the show. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, no, there you are, you're back. We have about 4 minutes left. Okay,
yes.
So we were just, so let's figure out how we're going to just close our show today with recapping what we've learned about plants communicating and the fact that we have to be really good observers and learn from plants and understand that if we think like plants, maybe we will learn even more. And
yes,
that many, many types of research are being done, as shown by Mancuso, on numerous types of plants. Both he talks about sugarcane and corn and
the mimosa, trees,
agricultural products, and all different kinds of plants that, that we're able to learn from, and that we continue, we need to continue to look at the biometrics and the signaling, modes of signals that they give to try and understand them. I mean, even all different kinds of animals, we're trying to understand their language, from monkeys to dogs to all different kinds.
Yes.
And
if you look, for instance, at dogs any animal, then the animal is sick, it knows exactly which plants to eat to get better. Yeah? And how does it know that? It didn't go to medical school. It didn't go to herbal school, but still it knows. So if we, even in veterinary science, if they would look at what the animals eat naturally when they are not feeling well, they would learn a lot more about how to treat the animals that we are breeding for food or for anything else. Yeah. So the whole problem with modern science is that it has all become very technical. Yeah. Even in that laboratory of Mancuso, it's all very technical. But they don't look all that much about how nature solves the problems, yeah? And then all of a sudden they discover something, and then they immediately want to exploit it for some technical advantage. And I think that is the wrong way to go about.
Right. I think that is the key. The exploitation of the everything that is in our world. We're supposed to be the keepers of the earth and maintain it and nourish it and learn how to live in harmony and balance with it. But the problem is exploitation, greed, wanting to gain one over another. Just like we said earlier, that we are only looking at what the plants can give us in terms of food production, rather than in looking at the spiritual aspect, that they can enhance us at a much deeper level than simply, you know, if you put plants in your home, how much calmer and soothing it can be to your environment. And we need
to learn that. We have to, of course, also look how can we do something for the plant. Yeah.
Good.
And that has been neglected since the so-called Green Revolution started. They don't look at what we can do for the plants. They can only look at how can we get more out of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Taking and taking as your only goal, will ultimately result in getting less than you wanted. And we see that in our modern crops, they're all fed these chemicals, but still we lose 25% to 30%. Yeah, each farmer has 25% to 30% crop loss every year.
Well, we have 60 seconds left, so I'm going to say thank you. We will continue with this discussion. It's been very enlightening, and I love having you with me. Okay, bye bye, everybody.
Bye bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens with co-hosts Kaviraj Vaikuthanath and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to get some sunshine and light up your life in your garden.